Good afternoon and welcome to Everyday Law. I am your host, Bob Clark. As always, the matters that we discuss here on Everyday Law do not reflect the opinions of Howard County Community College. And insofar as we get into the nitty-gritty of the law, we are not attempting to provide legal advice to anyone. If you have a legal problem, it is imperative that you actually seek out your own lawyer and speak to them about things knowledgeably. Today, we have the privilege of having as our guest Bernard L. Taylor, Esquire. Mr. Taylor is a member or is an employee of the Maryland Crime Victims Resource Center and has had a long and distinguished career in the state of Maryland. Welcome to the show, Mr. Taylor.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be here, believe.
So we were chatting about things a little bit beforehand, and the victims' rights world is an interesting and somewhat complex one historically. I had mentioned to you that I thought it had been embodied in the Maryland Declaration of Rights, effectively the Maryland Constitution, and you had said,
yes, it is. It's in fact part of the Maryland Constitution. I believe it was adopted in the late 90s, okay. And I think it's Article 46 of the Maryland Declaration of Rights.
You have had a varied career predating even becoming a lawyer, and you had indicated to me earlier that that had been in part the inspiration for your becoming a lawyer. Could you chat a little bit about that?
Sure. After spending a good deal of time in college, maybe more so than most, when I got out, of course, my majors were not very useful unless I wanted to teach in a high school somewhere, and I wasn't interested in teaching a captive audience. I would have much preferred to have taught people who voluntarily were present in some form or another.
Like at Howard County Community College.
Absolutely. And I am a product of the community college in Baltimore County.
Okay.
Mainly because I was such a mediocre student in high school. I didn't think that I would be successful in college. College was beat into me by my father. And so I enrolled in what was then Catonsville Community College, which is now part of the Baltimore County Community College system, and found out I did very well. It was something that made me interested in learning.
What brought about the transformation, do you think? Was it that you suddenly were not conscripted to go to school but were going voluntarily, or how did that work?
I think what it was is that they would cram an entire year's worth of a course into 14 weeks. And basically say, here's the book, come to class, and it's up to you. You weren't compelled to go. So that voluntary aspect of it, plus it was a bit faster.
Sure.
It was a faster pace. It was a bit more interesting. It wasn't boring. They would cram into two classes a week what you would pick up in five classes a week in a high school. So I think I really enjoyed that. Then I transferred. I went locally. I paid my own way. Me and my brother did, despite the fact that my parents beat college into us. They did nothing to create a fund. But those sorts of things didn't exist back in those days before computers.
And school was cheaper back in those days.
Oh, they were absolutely cheaper. I worked part-time during the school year, full-time during the summer, digging holes and filling them up with concrete. And that was plenty of money to buy my books, pay my tuition and fees, and get me back and forth with a few bucks left over for beer.
So what about your community college career directed you ultimately to becoming a lawyer?
Well, nothing actually in the undergraduate realm or even the graduate realm. I was an English major.
Okay.
In the community college, it was the core courses called general education in those days. And then when I transferred to UMBC, I became interested in English literature and American literature. And I liked it and I did well. And of course, it prepared me to do nothing in the real world. As all my jobs, I fall into them.
Okay.
I fell into a job as a courtroom clerk in Howard County Circuit Court from 1977-76, excuse me.
So what do courtroom clerks do? I see them all the time, but I was
well,
a little uncertain.
Well, they swear in witnesses. They participate in jury selection by swearing jury in voir dire. The judges usually now will designate a foreperson after the defense and the state or the defense and the plaintiff have exercised their peremptory challenges. Then the court will number the jurors and put them in the box. I would swear the jury in and then swear in witnesses, accept evidence, mark it, keep track of it, whether it was for identification or it was actually admitted, make sure that the right evidence went into the jury room when the jury retired to deliberate. and then hang around and wait.
So did you find that to be interesting work?
I found watching it interesting. Being the clerk was not that interesting. It was rather intimidating because here you are. You have a responsibility as some green kid sitting in a courtroom making sure that the right stuff went into the courtroom, into the jury room, and the stuff that was not accepted in the evidence stayed out. I didn't act as a bailiff. They had bailiffs to do that, to watch it, sit outside the jury room, make sure nobody spoke to them during their deliberations. And then I would take the verdict and roll the verdict, sometimes poll the jury. So those things were kind of interesting, but I kind of was interested in watching lawyers work. Half the time I didn't know what they were talking about, naturally, especially on motions. And I guess that kind of piqued my interest into trying to figure out what they were talking about. So I went to law school, dropped back 10 and punted and went to law school and came out and would be in courtrooms and still didn't know what they were talking about.
So I gather in the evolution of your career, at some point in time, you figured out what they were talking about and you had a series of fairly diverse and interesting jobs.
Yeah, when I got out, my interest was always in criminal law.
Okay.
They were the most interesting cases.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's a perverse interest. You know, what makes you slow down and look at an accident? I don't know. You know, why people behave like they do and what they do, and basically how depraved they can be.
Okay.
You know, okay. Honestly, it has a certain morbid fascination, I suppose. And I thought that prosecution work would be something that would appeal to me.
Were you correct?
Yes, actually, I spent 20 years doing it, so yes, okay. It did. I liked, when I was a prosecutor, being part of the hunt.
Okay.
And those would be primarily when I was a drug prosecutor. You would get involved in police investigations sometimes early on, and you didn't direct it, you participated. I never felt like I directed an investigation. When I went to the Attorney General's office, it was more white-collar work.
Attorney General of the State of Maryland.
State of Maryland, that's okay. Correct.
Who was the Attorney General when you were working there?
Joseph Curran.
There you go, Joe Curran.
Yeah, Joe Curran. And
great man.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was, he left you do your job. When you're ready to indict, you would send a proposed press release out to him for review, and he'd call you with questions.
Interesting.
You know, he just did not let things go. He
was a hands-on guy.
He was a hands-on guy, but not micromanaging. Well, you can't when you have 350 lawyers working for you or more now. Who knows? But with the Attorney General, they have no direct subpoena power. So every investigation is a grand jury investigation. If you need bank records, you go to the appropriate grand jury and ask them for a subpoena. You sit with investigators and sometimes police officers and talk about who should be interviewed next, what's the next step in the process. And over half of it was really trying to put people in a box, you know, dealing with real or imagined defenses that may be possible in their case and negating them before you would send out what I think is called in the Northern District of Virginia, the U.S. Attorney's Office, a Mae West letter. Why don't you come up and see me sometime?
I like that.
And then you would sit down and generally present what you have and make them a proposal.
Sounds a little bit like what's going on with Robert Mueller these days, huh?
It's the same sort of thing, yes. Yes. It's the same sort of thing, although I never dealt directly with political corruption, although I was exposed to it through the State Prosecutor's Office when I was a law clerk. I worked there for a while I was in law school.
Sure.
So it's the same sort of thing. It's follow the money.
So why do you think you ended up becoming a prosecutor rather than a defense lawyer?
I don't know. It's not so much a white hat syndrome. I just felt like it was the right side of things. Because prosecutors are not required to just prove a case. They're required to do justice. So in that sense, they're compelled by ethics to do the fair thing, to do the right thing. You don't indict someone or charge someone because you think they're a bad person. They may be a bad person, but you may not have the facts. So you get to do that. You get to make those decisions that you that are right for the people, not just a client. So, and that's what prosecutors do, and that's what's different about my current job. Prosecutors are not compelled to seek approval from victims. They call the shots. Victims are really, or victim survivors are nothing more than potential witnesses in a case. But they do have certain protections and rights that are created by the Maryland Constitution and various statutes.
And that's a comparatively modern phenomenon. When I say comparatively modern, you know, I've been a lawyer for 36 and a half years. So it's something that has become more prominent during the span of my career and yours too.
Absolutely. When I first became a prosecutor, there was no requirement that you give, that you sit down and talk to a victim about restitution.
And what is restitution?
So restitution under Maryland law are out-of-pocket expenses, okay, uncovered medical expenses, uncovered property damage. It can include lost wages if you're injured. Those sorts of things. It don't deal in punitive damages or other compensatory damages to make that person whole. It's strictly out-of-pocket expenses. Victims have a right to that. The state does not have to seek it. But the state has to ask the victim about it and talk to the victim about that aspect of a case. In fact, I had a case a couple of weeks ago in Baltimore County where the prosecutor didn't do that at all.
So what's the recourse if the prosecutor doesn't bother to do that?
Oh, I embarrassed him in court.
Okay.
I mean, he had it coming. He didn't, you know, I thought the guy was going to talk to my client. And the next thing I know, he's calling the case and putting a plea deal on the record.
I see.
So when it came time for my client to read a victim impact statement into the record, I added that no one ever spoke to him about restitution and that he's entitled to it and he's entitled to a restitution hearing. And I don't care if it queers the deal because you should have done your job.
Interesting. So how prevalent is that phenomenon?
Well, I don't know. In a year's work, it was the first time I saw it.
Okay.
In a year, and that was only a couple months ago, almost a year. And I don't know what the guy was thinking. I honestly don't know what he was thinking.
I mean, you have some idea from having been a prosecutor yourself that there's often a lot of cases that they've got to work with and a lot of witnesses and things like that might distract you a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. You get busy if it's a complex case. But in this instance, should have been readily apparent to him because it was an automobile DWI accident.
Okay.
And really messed this guy up. It was apparent from the police reports that he had serious injuries. So it seems to me it would follow that that would be one I to dot and one T to cross.
So is there any that you know of existing sort of fail-safe to make sure that there's some victim rights, at least opportunity to speak up in cases on a routine basis in Maryland?
That's what we're here for.
Okay.
The Maryland Crime Victims Resource Center will supply a lawyer if you want one, free of charge, to just make sure that all those I's are dotted and T's are crossed.
So tell me a little bit about how this organization came into being.
Okay, well, in 1982, a young woman who was a senior in college at Frostburg State, I guess it's just Frostburg College now, they cut out the state part, was about a month away from graduating. She came home to Prince George's County, where she was living with her parents when she was not in school, went to see a friend of hers one evening. On her way home, she developed car trouble, and two thugs decided they were going to help her out, and they tortured her, raped her over a five-hour period, and then finally murdered her.
Oh, Lord.
The Ropers, the Vince and Roberta Roper, who is still active in the organization, she's on the board of directors. Her friends and neighbors decided to gather around them to support them in some way, and they felt that the courts were not required to hear from victim survivors or victims. It was not part of the law, and they felt that that was not a right thing. So there was a Stephanie Roper committee formed, and then it was incorporated subsequently into the Stephanie Roper, I think, committee and foundation as two separate entities. And then in the early 2000s, they merged into the Maryland Crime Victims Resource Center. We have three locations, actually more now, because through grants, the organization decided that they needed more presence in counties where we had a presence, but they wanted someone there.
Sure.
So they hired, they doubled their lawyer staff. I'm one of them. My bailiwick, as it were, is Howard, Carroll, and Baltimore counties.
Okay.
They have a lawyer who handles Western Maryland from Hagerstown West, and they have one for Montgomery and Frederick County. They have one for the Eastern Shore, and they just hired someone for the Southern Maryland.
Okay. Meaning St. Mary's County.
St. Mary's, Calvert, Charles.
Prince George's.
Well, Prince George's is handled by a lawyer who's on staff and has been on staff for a long time.
Okay.
PG in Baltimore City, as you know, or I can't say PG, I would upset Mr. Miller, but
Prince George's County?
Yes, Prince George's County is the second busiest jurisdiction for criminal cases in Maryland. Baltimore City's the first. The third, I'm not sure. I think it's a toss-up between Baltimore County and Montgomery County.
I think that's a good bet.
And then it's more sparsely populated.
Sure.
Prosecutors' offices all vary in some ways. For example, Howard County has an excellent victim witness unit, which they, you know, I really don't have to do a whole heck of a lot.
We had Kim Oldham on recently, deputy prosecutor here, who's running to become the state's attorney for Howard County, and that was kind of one of her big things.
Oh, yeah, and she was in the office when I was in that office.
Oh, was she really?
Oh, yeah. She had an office across the way and one step over. Yeah, so, yes, I'm very familiar with Ms. Oldham, and I think she would be an awesome prosecutor.
You know, I hate to proselytize on her behalf unduly, but she does seem like somebody who would do a marvelous
job.
Yeah,
so that's another plug.
It is my intention on Everyday Law to have her opponent on, whoever that might be, to give them fair time, because it may be somebody who's perfectly capable and has other ideas and that sort of thing. But I have been very impressed by Kim.
Yeah, and I hadn't heard anything about anybody running against her yet, but I don't know. I'm not in Howard County as much as I used to be many moons ago.
So just on a hypothetical basis, assume that I am a family member of someone who has been badly injured in a crime. How would your organization come to my attention in the first place?
Well, you see, that's one of the problems is getting the word out. My approach to dealing with the jurisdictions where I'm assigned has been first go to the prosecutor's office and say, hey, here I am. I hope to be a big presence here or a bigger presence. Do not hesitate to get in touch with us or refer victims to us. I've written letters of introduction to police departments, but, you know, short of going to every shift briefing for every squad in every precinct in every jurisdiction, it becomes rather impractical, although that probably be a way, because the first line a victim will speak to most of the time is a police officer.
Absolutely.
And it would be nice. There is, interestingly enough, a requirement under the law for the Maryland Police and Correctional Training Commission to offer training, which is supposed all police
to police officers.
To police officers, and they are supposed to take the course. I haven't heard of a recent one being offered. But that is something that I guess will be on my radar screen if nobody else can find the time to do it, is to bug them about offering it again for police officers to be aware of us, aware of victim rights primarily, but aware of our organization.
I mean, I would presume that the police being aware of this resource, it's something that would be very useful for them in terms of the public perception of the police officers and the state's attorneys and might even reduce their burden somewhat.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And our job is not to supplant the police's involvement. It's not to supplant victim witness unit involvement because, like I say, Howard County does an awesome job. Other jurisdictions, it's budget issues and priority issues that will have fewer people. And we have victim advocates working at the Crime Victims Resource Center who will go to court even if they don't want a lawyer to go with them.
So they would be somebody who's trained to kind of express the victim's feelings and needs in a kind of less lawyerly way. Is that a fair?
Well, I don't think they directly address the court because they can't. But right. I think what they do is that they're there for moral support.
Sure.
They're there certainly to help explain the process to them, which I think is a big benefit to prosecutors.
Absolutely. Save them a lot of time.
It takes them a lot. Save them a lot of time. They have someone who can sit down and say, listen, this is how the process works.
Have you found that there is ever a disconnect between the prosecutors, the police, and the victims during your time doing this work?
No, not really.
Okay.
Not really. The police do their job. They come to court. After they do their investigation, charges are placed. They are really not that involved, if at all, with the victim. That's the job of the prosecutor, the victim witness unit, and us.
Okay.
We have, for example, we certainly can refer people for counseling if they need counseling for emotional trauma. We have a counselor, a therapist on staff who can offer that. So we do have resources. And in fact, if there is a civil question that arises out of it, a set of facts, we can refer to lawyers who will
like me.
Yes. Who will at least do an initial consultation for free.
Sure.
To explain the civil end of things. Our involvement as lawyers, in addition to going to court and stepping in if necessary, as I described to you, we also have received referrals from Hope Works, for example, where the defense has issued subpoenas for treatment records, therapy records, which the prosecutor's office really doesn't have standing to bring a motion to quash, because those confidentiality provisions of the law or privilege provisions of the law are personal to the victim. The state can't step in and say, quash this subpoena.
You need private defense counsel.
Yes. You need us to do it. And I've done those several times.
Okay. And how well does that go typically?
Oh, they don't get what they want.
Okay, that's the question.
Because they're not entitled to it.
Oddly, I'm doing one tomorrow morning in Howard County. So
oh,
that's
are
why
you?
I just
are
happened
you?
To pose that to you.
A lot of luck.
Thank you. Thank you. Might get snowed on, so we'll see.
We'll see.
So, again, hearkening back, the public, you know, I don't know how well known. I know that the victim's rights notion is something that's spreading much more. And I know that the Stephanie Roper story has been writ large in Maryland. And thank goodness for that, because it really does emphatically show how important it is to have resources such as you describe. Do you find that people know about your existence and understand the benefit that they can accrue from you?
Generally, no.
Okay.
I think that most of my referrals have been through prosecutors' offices. In fact, one came in, the victim hasn't decided whether to use our services. They didn't know about us except for my supervisor, who was covering Carroll County, was in court and was like, oh, there's such a thing as lawyers who represent victims in criminal cases. I did not know that. And this is from someone who worked in the courts up there for years and years and years. So that's a problem that we're trying to do through programs like this.
Sure.
To let people know that we exist and we can help them. And we get help through Hope Works organizations, domestic violence organizations, child abuse organizations, and we work hand in hand with them if they wish. There is, for example, Bikers Against Child Abuse. They will go to court with a kid dressed in the regalia, you know, cutaways, patches, bandanas.
You ever dress that way, Bernie?
No, actually, if you handle a case with them, they will give you a handle,
okay,
a street name, okay. and
do you have one?
No,
okay,
no, I haven't had.
Are you working on that?
I would like one, to tell you the truth.
Anything particular you'd like to be referred to as henceforth?
Nah,
okay,
I don't know. I would leave that up to those guys. They're much more creative. Well,
maybe we'll have them on the show sometime,
and I think that would be an awesome thing to do.
Wonderful.
These guys are great.
Yeah,
they're just great. They go to school with the kid sometimes. They give the kid a handle. They give him the regalia in small size.
Sure, sure.
They act as protection in a way, emotional protection. They don't actually, you know, they have a step between the kid and the perp in court, basically to separate them. So that's happened. It hasn't led to fisticuffs or Donnybrook in the halls of a courthouse anywhere. But they do that. There's organizations. There's Fido's for Freedom, I think it's called, where they will bring dogs into courtrooms for kids to feel
more
safe
comfort.
comfortable while they're testifying. So there are a lot of organizations that we can refer people to.
Is there some place that we can go to on the web see all of this information?
Oh, sure, sure.
And where is that?
That's www.mdcrimevictims.org.
Okay. And that's an umbrella website for all kinds of stuff?
That is a website for us.
Okay.
Now, if you wish us to assist you, you can either apply online or you can call a toll-free number.
What's that number?
Number is, I knew you'd ask that question. Hang on a second. I know I have it.
And while you look for it.
I got it right here. It is 1-877-VICTIM-1.
Okay, that's a good one. 1-877-VICTIM-1.
And you can call and apply over the phone. In order to get us as lawyers to represent you, we ask, after we talk to a victim and see if they wish us to go to court with them or if they have a need, of course,
sure,
we ask them to sign a representation letter.
So does money change hands on this?
No, okay. Absolutely. It's totally free.
Wow.
If you feel like you wish to make a donation, we're happy to accept it.
Sure.
But beyond that, no, it's free of charge. The only thing that we would potentially charge for are some out-of-pocket expenses. There are times, and I don't know that we've ever asked for it from a victim, where if a court decides it's not going to do what it's obligated to do under the law, we would file a petition for writ of mandamus.
To compel them to do it?
To compel them to do it. And that has happened.
Well, that's interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What sort of thing does that occur under?
Usually in restitution issues.
Okay. Now, one other thing about restitution, there is something called the Criminal Injuries Compensation Board also.
Yes.
Is that something that you all have any interactions with, or is that separate?
Yes, we do, but that is strictly a pro bono by one of our lawyers.
Okay.
My supervisor will do Criminal Injury Compensation Board cases, but it's not something that she gets paid out of grants because our grants don't cover that. We go to parole hearings, because victims have a right to be notified of parole hearings, administrative release, which is a new concept, which allows the Division of Correction to release prisoners without a parole hearing.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's something that's relatively new. Victims are entitled to that notice. They're entitled to notices about any motions to reduce sentence, what are called three-judge panels or review of sentences, appeals, releases from prison. Those sorts of things victims are entitled to know.
Well, thank goodness for that. It seems amazing to me, truly, that wasn't the case for a long time in our
country. It wasn't. No, you're absolutely right. That somebody could hit the streets after being released from prison on parole and the victim would never know it.
Wow. Well, we're kind of moving towards running out of time in this. This does seem like we could easily do a multi-hour show with you telling us the different facets of the victim's rights movement, and in particular your organization, but I'd like to thank you very much, Bernie, for coming on the show today.
Oh, it was my absolute pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Any final words of wisdom for crime victims about how to vindicate their rights or where to look?
Just come to us. Certainly stay on top of your case, if at all possible. If you follow the demand for rights and notice in the case, then you will receive those notices.
Sure.
Whenever a defendant is required to be present in court, you are also
allowed to
be present in court. So it will help people with treatment, emotional therapy, the trauma. It will help people write their victim impact statements. Will help them gather documents to support their claims for restitution. We offer all of that sort of thing. And I know victim witness units depends on the jurisdiction. Some are better than others, and some are just constrained by time and lack of resources. So we can step in and help in that way, in those jurisdictions that don't have the depth that Howard County has. But call us.
Well, thank you very much. This is Bob Clark. This has been Everyday Law. Look forward to speaking with you next week.